This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
When every second, every day, when every action, every thought will tell the world how you cast your vote.
Good morning. Good morning. It is 5 minutes after 8 o'clock in the morning. You are listening to KBOO, your very own community radio station, and this is Positively Revolting. I'm Ani.
I'm Lynn.
And today we have with us on the program Stuart Perrin, author of the new novel Little Sisters, and the Portland police officer Mike Gallagher of Human Trafficking Task Force. They're here to help our community discuss and understand the overwhelming issue of human trafficking, both globally and here at home in Cascadia. Good morning, Stuart.
Good morning.
And good morning, Mike.
Good morning.
Thank you both very much for joining us. This is a huge topic. It's one that I've been wanting to address for quite some time now, and I'm really happy that you've made the time to come in and talk with us this morning. It's an overwhelming topic, one that a lot of people want to, rather ignore or be in denial about. It's hard to talk about, and I really thank you for the work you're doing on it. Let's get sort of straight into things. Stuart, let's start with your novel as a sort of a background, a way to get this story started. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about your book and the circumstances that led you to write it?
Well, the circumstances are very interesting. In 1992, I knew nothing about human trafficking. Basically, what I was doing was setting up meditation centers around the world. And that was really my work. And a couple of students of mine came to me and said, why don't we set up a meditation center in Kathmandu? And I said, wow, what a fabulous idea. I said, you know, I've taken so much out of Asia, maybe we can give something back. And anyway, we set up a center there, and Chris Jones, who's here with us today, she was there in Kathmandu and, you know, teaching at the center. She called me up one day and said, Stuart, I love this place. It's exotic. It's fantastic. I don't know what I'm going to do with my time here. I said, Chris, don't worry about it. You're in one of the poorest countries in the world. Something is going to come along that's going to take up your time. Anyway, 2 days later, she calls me up and says she met Dr. Aruna Upreti, who ran an organization called REST. And REST was an organization of doctors that used to go into the villages in Nepal and bring medical attention and help. And Aruna introduced Chris to this whole problem of trafficking of children, 8 years old, 10 years old, 12 years old, 14 years old, that were being bought from families in the villages, smuggled into India, and put in places like Falkland Road. I don't know if you know anything about Falkland Road, but it's one of the great horrors on the earth.
Yeah, let's assume that we don't know anything about Falkland Road. What is that? What
well,
happens?
It's the red light district in Mumbai. And it's, you know, if you go through that place, you see, you know, 10-year-old girls in cages being sold to truck drivers and, you know, guys that are walking down the streets. And I'm not talking one or two. I'm talking thousands of them. I mean, they're everywhere. They're like little peacocks dressed in saris and all made up and sitting there in cages, sitting there behind windows. And what they're being trafficked to these people. Well, anyway, it was probably when Chris told me this, I said, Chris, this has to be our work. We have to do something about this. And we set up an organization called the Bahini Foundation. And we started to work with doctors, NGOs to find children that were prime targets. And we eventually had at least 20 children living in our house. We ran this organization in Kathmandu for 2 years. And Chris started getting kind of an emphysema. It's a very polluted place, Kathmandu. Mm-hmm. She started getting emphysema. And I said, look, let's talk to Aruna. We'll give over the organization to Aruna. She'll continue to run. And we did that. It became incorporated under the auspices of REST. At any rate, we ran this organization for 2 years, and we had children that could have been trafficked. We had children that came out of brothels. And we discovered probably one of the greatest horrors that existed on the earth, where children literally were taken, that the traffickers would tell their parents, look, we'll bring them to India, they'll work in wealthy families, they'll send you money, blah, blah, blah. They would take these children, they would rape them, they would torture them, they would literally extract their souls out of them and turn them into a body that would sleep with 20 men a day. And they became ultimately like used up tissues. When they got AIDS, they got HIV, they were used up, they would just toss them out. And there was nowhere for these people to go. They would go back to Nepal. They wound up being prostitutes on the street. And the whole problem of AIDS became rampant in India. It still is rampant in India. Mm-hmm. Anyway, this is how it started. And the book came out of this. We did a five-minute, Chris is an extraordinary singer. And we did a five-minute video called My Name is Gita. And very touching. In fact, at the Atkinson Memorial Church, we're going to start the program with that video. And I saw the video, and I was so moved. I said, no, this has got to be something bigger. It's got to touch the world. I mean, the whole world's got to know about this thing. Mm-hmm. Now, this was back in 1995, where I promise you, you know, people were deaf and dumb. You would talk to people about this and people, well, what do we, you know, it's Nepal, what do we care?
What does it have to do with me? What could I do about
exactly,
it? It's so far away.
Exactly, it's so far. And, you know, even in Nepal, well, it's their karma. Mm-hmm. You understand? It's their karma. Their next lives will be better. This is what we used to get back from mm-hmm. people. So I said, no. I sat down and honestly, Little Sisters, the story, not the novel, but the story was written in 3 weeks. It was like a force that wrote itself. It had to be written. And I said, you know, I don't want to just write about Nepal. I want to combine East and West and bring the whole, you know, all different social classes into this thing. So I made it into a kind of a multicultural love story, or it made itself into a multicultural love story. And then I tried to get it published. And nobody cared. Nobody listened. I had a even had an agent in Hollywood trying to promote it as a movie. And I couldn't get any response to it, put it away. About 3.5-4 years ago, I was living with this thing. I always tell people I was pregnant with this book for 18 years. And then I had 4 years of hard labor to make it what it is today. And about 4 years ago, I took it out of my drawer and I read it. And I said, this has got to be a novel. I wrote it as a novel. And I have a literary agent. And she knew nothing about this part of my life. I told her about it, and she just flipped out. She's really the ultimate social activist, this agent of mine, anything about it. And when I told her the story, she flipped out. And then I started working. It took 3.5 years to produce this book. I'm talking 10, 12 hours a day, working till early hours in the morning. And it came out about 2-3 months ago. And hopefully it's going to start making people aware. It's like an engine, I think, that can make people aware of one of the most greatest travesties that exists on the earth. You know, I'm talking 10-year-old children who literally are sold into prostitution. Well, the family doesn't know what happens, but they're wound up being sold to brothels, and these kids having their lives, their souls, literally extracted from them.
And when one sort of starts to think about how could a family sell their children into this,
well,
looking at the larger economic scene of a family expecting to make $20 a year.
Well, that's in Nepal at that time, the average family income in villages was $15 to $20. A girl was worth less than a water buffalo because they had a sustainable economy. Everything they lived on came out of the earth. So a water buffalo was a very valuable, they plowed the fields with water buffalo. And a child, a girl, not a boy, a girl.
Yes, girls in particular.
All right. You had the problem of dowry.
Mm-hmm.
You understand? You have a problem that if your daughter doesn't get married, it is a disgrace to the family. Now, you have to get a dowry. You get a dowry in one of two ways. Either you have it, or the very poorest people would make themselves into indentured servants. They would borrow money they could never repay, and they became the slave of some person who was a moneylender for the rest of the, and then often would go down from generation to generation. Now, some trafficker walks in the village and says, I'll give you $200 in rupees, you know, for your daughter, this child who is like an appendage in the family they want to get rid of.
Mm-hmm.
They sell the children. She will go to India, she'll send you back money, you'll get rich, she'll, you know.
And of course, you know, the traffickers are not at all forthright about what actually is going to be the child's fate, so the family can sort of tell themselves a nice story, mm-hmm. even though no one sees these girls again, you know. But there's this level of denial and desperation that seems to feed into that particular scenario.
Now, you have to realize $200 in rupees is like 20 years' salary
mm-hmm.
for these people.
Mm-hmm.
So they would sell the children. And they had huge families. They might have 5, 6, 7 girls in a family. So they would sell these children and get money, and children would go off and wind up on Falkland Road or somewhere in Calcutta or Mumbai or in Delhi, and they would be working in these brothels, you know?
And I think a lot of people, when people think about human trafficking and think about child sex slavery, we always tend to, again, sort of cushion it and say that's something that happens far, far away, or it used to happen, or it's some other place, and again, it has nothing to do with me. But in fact, Mike Gallagher, you're here with the Portland Police Bureau and the Human Trafficking Task Force. It does happen here. What does human trafficking look like in the Northwest? Who's being sold, and who's doing the selling?
And who's doing the buying?
It's who's doing the buying is anybody. And it's anybody from the low social economic classes to the rich. I mean, we have come in contact with Johns, who are lawyers, who are doctors, and have plenty of money that can, you know, fight the criminal battles that go on out there in regards to these cases. And who's doing the picking up these women? It's the pimps here in our society. It's very similar to what he's talking about in Nepal in a different cultural way. Mm-hmm. These women are picked up. Usually the typical age here in the United States is 13 years old, introduced into prostitution, and are stay with their pimps for several years and thrown away, like he says, when they're no longer of value.
Mm-hmm.
These women are taken away from their family, they're isolated, they're transported to different cities where they feel vulnerable and are basically sold to the highest bidder out there on the streets.
Do they usually come from you know, pretty sorry situations of abuse and...
It
or
can be.
Can they just, are they just grabbed from the streets?
It's a variety of things. It's maybe a classmate at school tries to talk them into, hey, this is a great way to make some money. They may sort of introduce them and tell them it's a, they don't necessarily have to have sex with a man or something like that. Maybe you could just go and have dinner with this person. But they slowly introduce them into this lifestyle of prostitution where once they have them and give them this opportunity to do this with a male, they are somewhat hooked because then they're, again, like I say, isolation is a huge part of this thing where they'll take them out of the city, they'll take their cell phones, they'll tell them their parents don't love them anymore, basically isolate them from their friends that they were with. Now they're stuck with this pimp and they have no other way to go to get out of this lifestyle. They don't know what to do to move beyond this. So they stay in it. And if the pimp feels they're not making enough money, there may be beatings, getting them to get out there, work more. He may sell them to another pimp, or like you said, just throw them out there. And then they're sort of stuck in that lifestyle. I don't know anything else. So they're stuck in this prostitution lifestyle.
What's the scope of the problem locally? How many people, I mean, I've heard that Portland is on the high end of the volume, the capacity of people being trafficked. How many people in the Northwest, in this area, are trafficked every year?
It's hard to put a number on it. I know we deal with a lot of different cases that are investigations, and for every probably case we're working on, there's probably 10 to 20 that we're unaware of. I can tell you there's websites out there now that have 150 to 200 ads of escorts on them daily. There's others that maybe have 200 or 300 more, and that's just one, two, three websites that we look at on a consistent basis. So, I mean, you're looking at any one time having 200, 300, 400 women out there on websites, and that's not counting the women that are out there working the streets and working the track here in Portland, which can be anywhere from 40, 50 to another 100 people at any one time. So it's a very big problem.
Can I interject something on this?
Please, of course.
To my understanding, human trafficking today is... There's something like 21 million girls and women being trafficked around the world today. It's a $32 billion a year industry. Now, I wonder about that. Not the figures, because I believe they're probably true. What I wonder is that nobody on Falkland Road has a mattress with $32 billion under it. Where that money is being laundered, who is... you know, shifting that money around the world.
Always a good question, Stuart, is to follow the money, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What bank accounts are where that money is being channeled to? I mean, that would be a really interesting investigative reporter thing to do, to find out about that stuff.
Exactly. I mean, that's actually, it's like you're reading my mind, Stuart. That's the next question that I wanted to sort of explore is, you know, we hear about, you know, the pimp, but an individual operator? It seems like there's a little more organization behind this and a little more concentration of power. I want to get into that in just a moment, but I want to remind people you are listening to KBOO, your community radio station. This is Positively Revolting with you every Friday morning, 8 to 9 o'clock. I'm Ani. I'm here with Lynn. And it is your program. Please call in with your questions and comments at 503-231-8187. You can also follow us on Facebook, where you can find us as Positively Revolting. You can also email us positivelyrevolting@gmail.com. Let's look at that issue of really following the money, and are we talking about, I mean, especially let's locally, you know, with the work you do, I was really wanting to know when you talk about prosecuting people when finally you're able to get to somebody who's doing the trafficking, who are you picking up for that? Are you finding mostly individual sort of lone wolf operators, or are you able to actually find some organization that is behind this, or organizations, organized crime, whatever, however that is?
It's very loosely organized. For the most part, pimps are independent. I mean, they will have gatherings where they get together and show off who they have working for them, so forth and so on. But, and you may have a pimp that's teaching another pimp how to do his job, and there's money that transfers a little bit up or down, back and forth that way. But for the most part, what I've experienced, that pimps are fairly independent because they want the money. That's what it's all about, is the money for them.
Are you finding most of the women being trafficked in this area are the runaways, are the kids lured away from home, are the kids that are disaffected, or are you finding also this is a problem for women being brought to the area, immigrant women, women being promised, you know, work far away that you can, you know, are we experiencing the other end of, you know, sell your kid and they might end up here?
Well, the prostitution team here in Portland, we have detectives downtown that work trafficking cases, the felony cases, and our team out at East Precinct works the street level and some of the escort stuff. What our experience here is not so much the slave-type trafficking issues. It's more what you said, the people that are found from troubled homes, the ones that have been abused physically and sexually, the ones that have problems with their parents that don't like the rules, and the people from the what we consider the normal families, two-parent, middle-income homes, are being lured away from these homes by the pimps. I mean, these guys typically can sell ice to Eskimos. I mean, they say what the women want to hear. They look at people who are having problems in their life that are maybe not as socially adept, that are having problems in school. They'll play up to their areas in their life that they need to hear, and pretty soon they're hooked up in what they think is a relationship with the pimp, somebody that they believe loves them, is going to take care of them. And bottom line, the pimp is all he's looking for is someone to sell and make money from.
Stuart, you really talk about the spiritual aspect of this, and you know, what kind of culture is it that it's all right to suck the souls of children? I mean, that sort of on such a huge level. Can you speak? That part just sort of racks me. Can you talk about that?
Well, I don't think it has to do with spirituality, or it has to do with economics.
Okay. Well, I was just looking at the
such extreme poverty that people have no choice in the matter. Now, of course, presently, there are organizations that have been set up in Nepal that are working with this. There's, for instance, REST. We got a call from Aruna about a year ago, and she told us, because we established the Bahini Foundation, which was the first organization, or one of the first organizations of its kind in Nepal, it saved the lives of 10,000 children over the years. And there's other people doing the same kind of work there. So they're getting into the villages, they're convincing the parents of the children to send the kids to these safe houses instead of sending them with the traffickers.
Eventually what happens? Are they adopted or what goes?
They're educated. Educated, yes. They're sent to school.
We should do that in America.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Many of them go on to colleges in Nepal and India. Some of them come to the... I mean, when Chris and I were doing it, our goal was to set up a situation where we would take the best and the brightest of them, bring them to the United States, educate them, and part of the education was to bring them back to Nepal where they would really contribute something to their society, their culture. Now, this is deeply rooted in, also it's deeply rooted in their religion. They have, you know, girls that are dedicated to temples there. They have, I think they're called Kumari, and there's other names for them. And these girls literally become prostitutes in the temples. They service the priests. They service, you know, people like that. And it's integral to their culture. It's something that's so bizarre that nobody in the Western world can even understand it. I don't understand it to this day, but it goes on. It's even been outlawed, but it still goes on. Just as dowry has been outlawed, but it still goes on. Just as caste has been outlawed, but it still goes on.
Or sati.
Or sati has been outlawed, and it still goes on. Yeah. All of this stuff is so deeply rooted in their culture that literally people have to be extricated from that and educated. The big factor is education. Mm-hmm. Now, I went to an event 2 days ago at the Asia Society in New York, and it was called Girl Rising. and they were talking about children in these indigenous children in third world countries and the education of girls to empower them. Now, I think this is extraordinary. But the one thing that was missing is the education of boys and allowing boys to recognize that girls are human beings. You don't traffic human beings. You know, that without girls, without boys, the earth doesn't continue. So somewhere in all of this, people have to learn to relate to each other, love each other, respect each other. And to my understanding, the only way this is going to take place is through, I wouldn't say religion, but through spirituality, mm-hmm. where people learn to live with, you know, like the Dalai Lama talks about, you get wisdom, you live with compassion. You understand? It's really learning how to become human. And if people are taken at the youngest ages and they're trained that way, you could have a different cultural aspect in these environments where they grow up to respect mm-hmm. women. They respect men. There isn't this constant war going on between people.
It would seem, though, that there needs to be a two-part solution. There's the spiritual, you know, awakening that we are human and these are human beings and we can't put them in cages and sell them.
Exactly.
But there also needs to be the fix in the economic factors that provides the crushing reality that there are people who are existing on $20 to $50 U.S., you know, cash a year.
Well, you haven't. You haven't.
It right.
needs to be too far. But, you know, these are not separate things.
Right.
These
Absolutely.
Are things that work together.
Absolutely.
Once you learn to open your heart, once you learn to be a compassionate human being, understand you don't treat other people that way. You try to uplift people. You try to help them. You try to educate them. You try to bring to them a higher level of consciousness, which enables them to evolve in their life. And I think that it's a problem that is twofold, and these two things have mm-hmm. to be unified, and they're not separate from each other.
Mm-hmm.
They really are one and the same thing, but one will nurture the other.
I want to look at the fact it's 8:30 in the morning. We have James on the line. If you would like to join us, please do. You can give us a ring at 503-231-8187. And good morning to you, James.
Good morning.
Go ahead.
International slave traders resented the fact that we were going to free our slaves during the Civil War. So they usurped our central government from the top through the Bank of England. Basically, what has happened is all of the power that we've given to the central authority has gone to that international oligarchy. And we have literally been enslaved as a nation. We are under complete monopoly rule, and they will eventually do to us what they did to India, to where we will be so impoverished that we will be living like this, like they do.
All right. Thanks very much, James.
Mm-hmm.
Looking at a couple different things. There's the ability to relate to each other and respect each other, hold each other as, you know, human beings, and certainly to my mind, sacred beings. But again, the environment or the economic factors that are really a global situation that also needs to be addressed concurrently so that people aren't so, I don't want to say, really duped into parting with their children. That's abroad, but at home, coming back to the Northwest, how is it that the economic factors certainly seem to be present, but there seem to be other factors in the Northwest that seem to be major contributors? And again, that's sort of the alienation. What do you think are the major contributors, Mike?
As far as I use the word the pimps, the slave traders, mm-hmm. however you want to call it, a lot of them come from the lower social economic situations. Their families have been involved in this in the past. They may have you know, an uncle who was a pimp. They may have a sister or somebody that had been involved in that type of activity. So it's areas they're familiar with. It's easy to get into. A lot of the people that we've dealt with before in the gang issues have evolved from selling drugs to selling guns to now being involved in prostitution because there's a lot of money in this lifestyle. It's much harder for police and law enforcement to prosecute these cases because we're dealing with human beings, and that is our evidence. It's the case is your victim trafficking. Where before, if we had somebody that we arrested on a gun charge or a drug charge, we would have that evidence. We'd keep it for 6-8 months till the case went to trial, and then you'd pull out the evidence and present it to your jury or your judge. Now we've got a victim who's a real person who we have to keep track of for 6 to 8 months, and they may not want to just totally forget about what they were involved in. They may have moved on to another pimp. They may be living back in New York and not want to relive all the trauma they've been through. So it's very hard for these cases to go forward. And the pimps know this, and they do a lot, spend a lot of time brainwashing these women as to, you know, don't trust the police. All they're going to do is they're going to arrest you and throw you in jail. They're not going to help you, those types of things. So we have to overcome that type of learning and experience these women have gone through and been traumatized by.
Let's go ahead and talk to Annalisa. Good morning, Annalisa. You're on the air.
Good morning, Ani and guests. I have maybe a simplified question for the police officer, Mr. Gallagher. Maybe if you start on the other end, what if you arrest the people that buy these services, the people you just 5 minutes ago were talking about? What if you give them really strong sentences for buying services for trafficked girls or young women? What if we start on the other end? Maybe that might also be a question for Mr. Stewart, but in India, I have seen a documentary. It seems to be an almost impossible task. So what is being done to the men that buy these services? Thank you.
Thank you very much for your
call.
Thanks,
Annalisa.
In Portland, we're sort of unique where I feel we probably deal with or arrest as many men as we contact the women that we contact out there. A lot of cities, it's not done that way. It's much easier to do law enforcement targeting the women. We target the Johns as much as we target the women. There's legislation currently being looked at right now to enhance the penalties for Johns, who are especially buying minors, and to make it quite painful when they do get arrested and get convicted. Every John we come in contact with, we end up charging them with the crime of prostitution or some other related crime to that. And there's different pieces to the puzzle on how they can deal with that. They can plead not guilty, go to trial. They could plead guilty. We have an option for them to go to what we call a John school. We spend a day educating these men about prostitution, why these women are truly victims, try to show them that this isn't somebody out there wanting to engage in casual sex and just enjoys it. So we try to give them that piece of the puzzle that they may not think about, and hopefully that deters them in the future from going out there and doing that.
In Asia, you have, I think, first of all, I love the idea of arresting the people that use children and women this way. I think it's a very good idea. I think it's a law that should be, you know, just everywhere to take care of that. Because it would, you know, without, you know, it's a basic economic thing. You've got to have a marketplace. Without the marketplace, there's nothing to sell. So it needs to be there. But anyway, in Asia, you have, especially in places like Cambodia and Thailand, and a little bit in India, you'll have chartered planes fly in with, I'm talking 200-300 men from the Middle East, mm-hmm. from all over the place, for sex weekends with 12-year-old mm-hmm. children. Now, this is staggering that this can go on, but this is what happens. They just literally have these excursions, a weekend in Bangkok.
Sex tourism,
yeah.
Yeah. Again, staggering.
Staggering.
You are actually, you're speaking tonight in Portland. There's an event that's happening, and I want to make sure that people know about it. If folks want more information, you actually have two events coming up over the next few days. So tonight, you are speaking in Oregon City. Stuart, you're speaking at 7 o'clock, is that right?
Yes.
At the Atkinson Memorial Church, Unitarian Universalist. Talk about that presentation. What's going on tonight?
Well, it's basically an introduction or a presentation to make people aware of this very insidious problem that's going on, not only in Portland, but all over the world. Chris and I are both going to be involved, and Mike is going to be involved. And we're bringing our experience of, having worked in this area to this problem. We're going to be showing a video at this event. And the church has been, it all took place because they read this book of mine. And it so captured them that they said, we got to do something. So Chris and they have been talking about this, and we put this event together, and we thought it would be fantastic to have Mike on the panel, who is native to Portland, who can bring awareness to people of exactly what's going on here in Portland. So we put together a panel of Chris, myself, Mike, and a woman named Erin?
Erin Ellis,
who works with SARC.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And
that's the Sexual Assault Resource Center.
Right. So the four of us are going to be on this panel, and we're going to try to bring divergent views about this problem, make people aware of it, and hopefully some form of social activism will take place. It'll inspire people to do something with whatever they can possibly do to help alleviate and eliminate this kind of problem that exists. I mean, it's suddenly, because I wrote this book, it's starting to happen everywhere. And now I just got invited to do another program like that in New York at the Ethical Culture Society. I don't know if you know that place.
I'm not familiar with their work.
It's a very big venue in New York. And we did one at NYU and another one at another bookstore in New York. Mm-hmm. So it's been really growing, this thing.
And it's a way of getting the word out there and doing public education.
Exactly.
Getting people talking about the issue, both globally and wherever they happen to be. Because I'm thinking there's not really a corner of the world that this isn't happening in.
No, you're right. And, it says on the back of my book, out of the introduction, when children are sold into sexual slavery, the entire world must take responsibility. We can't. Everybody has to say, my God, it could be my daughter.
Mm-hmm.
It could be my son.
Mm-hmm.
It could be my whatever, mm-hmm. People have to develop a conscience about this.
Yes.
And it seems that, and education seems to be the first way to chip away at this enormous boulder. Enormous thing. And we have callers on the line because this is a talk show. We have Maggie on the line.
And if you'd like to join us, you can give us a ring at 503-231-8187. Morning, Maggie.
Hi. I have a two-part question, and maybe more to Mike Gallagher, but also to your other guests. I apologize. I didn't catch
Stuart Perrin.
What was that?
Stuart Perrin is the author.
Oh, wonderful. Okay, great. Thank you, Stuart Perrin. So either one and both probably could answer to this.
Okay.
So the question is, essentially, I know that a lot of some of the recruitment that occurs of getting girls and, I don't know, probably boys as well, into prostitution or into this human trafficking happens in middle school. And there are actually girls that will, be in there sort of like promoting, I forget what they call them, as far as just like they're like the senior females in the group, and they'll be in schools recruiting young females. And so my question is, as an educator, I know that I've been educating myself around this issue and signs to look for. So what would be something that teachers and counselors could do to intervene, or are you guys working around that issue? And then the other questions, I recall there's a chief of police, retired chief of police officer in Seattle, Norm Stamper, was working on that issue and kind of working with some Portland police officers regarding human trafficking, but I might be wrong on that. I thought I recall him being working a little bit on that issue. And so I'm just wondering, I know that funds for policing is not always there, and specifically for this issue, but what is Portland police doing to make sort of make that department, fund that department in that area of policing?
Gotcha. Thank you. Thank you very much, Maggie.
And so those are the two questions. Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm.
I know I can't answer the second question, but the first one I can. I mean, I think essentially is we have to learn to listen to children. We have to learn to not judge them. We have to learn to open to them and allow them to express what's going on inside them, and to develop a confidence in adults so they can really talk to us. We can't lecture them. Doesn't work anyway. We can't throw all kinds of dogma at them and righteousness at them because they don't understand it and they rebel against it. But if we just listen to them, if we allow them to become our teachers, and we learn from them exactly what is going on, they begin to develop trust. They begin to learn how to not be afraid to come to adults with their problems instead of going to pimps and, mm-hmm. you know, being lured out. And I think that this is essential, just learning to listen to children.
Mike, can you talk about the second part of that, how priority-wise? tough budget times. We always hear about, you know, budgets being cut and things happening that we just don't have the funding. Yeah, it's an important job, but we can't afford it. How's your ability right now to get resources to do the jobs that you need to do when it comes to the human trafficking division?
Right now, with our command staff, we're supported with the job that we do, and we do try to reach out to different community groups, and we've taught at some schools the education piece about what to look for. We would like to do more. We're working with different groups out there. We have really good partnerships with different groups that do education pieces out there, and they sometimes will ask us to assist them or mm-hmm. input on their types of stuff. There is that stuff out there. Sometimes I'm afraid that schools are afraid to ask about this. They want to turn the blind eye. It's not happening in our schools. It's not happening to our women that are in our class, mm-hmm. our girls that are in our classroom. But mm-hmm. it is. I can tell you that. And she's totally right about these girls being recruited at the younger age. Mm-hmm. There's the older girls that are, you know, have the nice stuff, the nice purse. They're getting their hair done all the time. And the younger girls looking up to them, well, how'd you get that? Well, let me introduce you to my boyfriend. He can show you how to get, you know, your nails done or get your hair done, those types of things. So that recruiting does go on as early as the middle school mm-hmm. grades.
And if we think back, I mean, you know, if we think back to middle school, there is that automatic sort of adoration of the girls that are 2 years older. Mm-hmm. You know, they seem, you know, 13, 14, totally worldly and sophisticated to the 11, 12-year-old who are immediately looking for that role model, you know, that more accessible role model. You know, adults, that's a whole nother being over there, you know. But I do remember, and I've seen that over and over again, that there's that real intense period of wanting to strive for the kind of maturity that you know exists in a 14-year-old when you're 11. So, you know, just getting that education in, that's getting into the schools, right. actually talking.
There's curriculum out there designed to address these issues and to educate both. When Stuart talked about educating the men, that's mm-hmm. that piece of the puzzle of it. As far as educating the young girls, the women that are out there, I know Shared Hope has a very good curriculum that goes out and travels around and does education pieces at schools and stuff like that, and they're very willing to do that. You just have to reach out to them to mm-hmm. come to your location to do those types of things.
What is Shared Hope?
It's a nonprofit group out of Vancouver that is very involved in the human trafficking aspect of this and educating people on what it's about and how to prevent it, and does presentations both at grade school levels, or I mean not grade school, but the middle school and high school levels as far as adults to educate them and sort of inform them what they can do to stop it.
I want to also remind folks that on Sunday, you will also be speaking here in Portland. So if folks can't make it to Oregon City tonight, on Sunday there is another opportunity to hear a presentation, and that's at the First Unitarian Church of Portland at Elliott Chapel, 1011 Southwest 12th Avenue. That's downtown at 12th and Southwest Salmon. That's at 12:15 on Sunday. Is that 12:45 on Sunday? Update.
Update this just from in. The room.
So is that the same sort of presentation, Stuart?
That's just going to be Chris and myself talking about our experiences in Nepal.
Okay. We have many folks wanting to speak. 503-231-8187 is the number to call. We have Sylvia on the line. Good morning, Sylvia.
Yeah, good morning. Listen, thank you for this program. I mean, this is really, really, really heavy stuff. When the man described how he wrote that book, it's quite profound. My question is, has he heard of a book called The Blue Notebook? And I think the author is James Levine, and I think he was a doctor or something and he worked with the World Health Organization or something. I happened to run across the book in the library a couple of years ago, and it's the personal account of one of those girls. She kept the notebook, and there are no words for it, but I was just wondering if he'd heard of it.
It's called what?
It's called The Blue Notebook. It's a small book, and it's her story. And then James turns around at something like 10 years later, and he writes, and he becomes the girl. It's riveting. It's heartbreaking. It's called The Blue Notebook.
No, I haven't heard of it, but I certainly will read it. Thank you.
Yeah, okay. Thank you for this program. Thanks,
Sylvia. Thank you, Sylvia. Take care. And we have only 10 minutes left. I do want to remind people that you are listening to KABU. This is Positively Revolting. I'm Ani.
I'm Lynn.
And this morning we have with us Stuart Perrin, author and teacher. You're a yoga instructor, I understand, your spare time.
Well, meditation.
Meditation instructor.
Yes.
And also Officer Mike Gallagher from the Human Trafficking Division of the Portland Police Bureau. We have a couple more callers on the line. We have somebody who is called to ask about the name of your book. That's Little Sisters, the novel that you've written based on your experiences in Nepal.
Yeah, it's published by Blue Kite Press.
Okay.
It's a small press, but it's...
Before we run out of time entirely, I want to ask, what can we do? This is an overwhelming problem. How can average folk here in the Northwest help to stop the trafficking of human beings? And when we say the trafficking of human beings, the vast majority are young girls.
I think education is a huge piece of it, educating the general public that it is going on. It's not one of those things that is in the back closet. It's out there. It's prevalent on 82nd Avenue. It's prevalent on the internet. I mean, when you have 300 ads a day posted here in Portland, and this is one city, and all of those women are out there, and there wouldn't be them doing that if there wasn't Johns willing to pay for sex. I mean, that they don't care whether they're 13 years old or whether they're 20 years old. They're looking for a sexual contact, and that's what they're going to get when they pay for it. The other piece is educating young women. I mean, I don't know whether it's putting a curriculum in schools to educate them about, to be aware of this, to be aware of what to look for. But I think there needs to be a bigger education piece with young adults, and to recognize when this is going on and how to avoid it.
I think also in much the same way that I felt like we really need to address global economic situations to really start eradicating and getting at the root of things. At home, it seems like there are basic services that have to do with alienation, that have to do with, I had done a program on child prostitution years ago now, and in talking to the four women who were now in their 30s, all four started because they had ran away because of sexual abuse in the home, or they were thrown out after coming out to their parents as being a lesbian, or somehow or another not fitting in. They experienced the shunning and being ostracized to the point of being put on the street, and finding at the age of 12 or 14 that this was their only option to eat. So it seems like there's other things besides identifying this child may be at risk, or this person is currently being trafficked. How do we address those deeper issues?
There needs to be resources available to those people, and we're getting better at having resources available, but it's very, very limited. When you have a 13-year-old who's used to running away because they don't like the rules, we don't have many mechanisms in place to hold them someplace. So we put them in a foster home, they run. We put them in another foster home, they run. We don't address the root problem of why they're running away or what the issues were at home. Like you said, I think we need to address that root problem and deal with those root problems and have the resources available to help them so they can move beyond that. Because that's what the pimp does. He steps in there and he addresses that problem.
Right.
He tells them everything that we need to know as it's related to that problem. So they end up basically looking at him as that person's going to take care of them, where we as society don't do that.
Can I interject something?
Please. You bet.
I think it really comes down to a very serious spiritual problem. You know, I mean, happy people don't do things like this. People that are full of love, that really have learned to live their lives consciously and develop their lives, like, don't traffic children. Don't, you know, use people that way. And I think that this gets down to a very personal ethic inside human beings. If they develop an inner life and they develop some kind of a spiritual life, whatever it is, it really is a way of alleviating the problem. And as I said before, you know, one of the most difficult things in the world is people learning to listen to each other.
Mm-hmm.
Just say, okay, somebody's different. And I don't have to put them down. I don't have to argue with them. I don't have to fight. I don't have to convince them I'm right. I can just open and learn. Maybe there's something they have to teach me.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I have a 17-year-old daughter, and every time I'm with her, she has something to teach me that sometimes shocks me, you mm-hmm. know? But I try to listen to her and learn from her and let her be my teacher. Let her show me how I have to interact with her. And I think that if people just learn to function this way, individuals suddenly raise their own level of life as well as the way they interact with other people. You know, and I think mm-hmm. it's really very important.
I agree. I so agree. We have one last caller. We want to sneak you in for a very quick comment or question. Marianne.
Yeah, I'm really glad that you've got an organization like this that's doing this. But I really question, especially in the developing countries. I mean, you can educate these, you can rescue these people and educate them, but are there really going to be jobs for them? I mean, we've got people with advanced college degrees in this country that can't find work. So it's really like a global economic problem that underlies all of this.
Yeah, I think that we have to. I mean,
it's all tied together.
It is foolishness to think that we can address the problem without also addressing the economics.
One thing we haven't addressed yet is the role of media in all of this.
Well, and I was particularly thinking about that with what Mike was talking about with girls wanting to have the latest whatever. Britney's out now. I'm not doing the right thing. Yeah, it's self-respect and self-esteem, and you don't need that quite so much. But they're watching things on media and wanting to imitate them. That's so huge now. I mean, it used to be.
I think it's always been huge.
It is way more with the internet and cable TV channels 24/7 having these. I don't watch TV, but when I'm around TV, those images are being slammed at you
and
all
media,
the time.
It's media without responsibility,
right?
You know, just it's money. That's all they see, and there's no responsibility.
And you have a culture that media-wise that portrays pimps as being good people. I mean, they're in the money, they're flashy, they're driving nice cars, they're not doing anything wrong, they're not forcing
making
these women
a video,
to do this.
Making a music video, yeah.
Right, and in reality, I mean, some of the horror stories I hear involving pimps are just absolutely disgusting, but the media doesn't portray those.
An important point. We are out of time, gentlemen.
Run out of show.
It is very good to talk to both of you about a topic that is absolutely overwhelming and pretty horrifying. I thank you for your time.
Thank you.
For people, I think it's important to stay involved in the discussion and to learn more about what's happening in our own backyard and how we can come together to say no. There is, of course, your speaking tonight in Oregon City. Again, that's at Atkinson Church, Atkinson Memorial Church, Universalist Unitarian. That's at 710 6th Street in Oregon City. That's tonight at 7 o'clock. Then Sunday afternoon, 12:45 downtown at 11th and Southwest Salmon at First Unitarian. So I hope people can take advantage of hearing you talk while you're in town this weekend. Thank you very much.
Thank you for
having us.
Thank you.
Yep. And we will be back next week, continuing to be positively revolting. So do please stay in touch. You can find us again on Facebook, Positively Revolting. You can email us, positivelyrevolting@gmail.com. Take care.
How did you get the name?
You are listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is approximately 9:01 a.m. Coming up this morning on KBOO, Voices of the Middle East welcomes Kathy Breen of Voices for Creative Nonviolence, who lived in Iraq prior to the U.S. invasion in 2002 and during the occupation. She returned to live there again for a few weeks late last year and reports on the reality of the lives of the people there. At 9:30, 5. Host Michelle Schroeder Fletcher speaks with Matt Briggs, director of Deep Green, Solutions to Stop Global Warming Now. Matt will be screening his film on Saturday at the Friends Meeting House. At 10 on Flashpoints, activists in more than 15 U.S. cities protest and fast in solidarity with the hunger strikers in Guantanamo. Also, an update on the treatment of Palestinian political prisoners, many now on hunger strike as well. A report on a national protest against drones planned for Saturday in Washington, D.C., and an update... And an update on the Exxon Arkansas tar sands pipeline gush. Air Cascadia is off today. At 11 a.m. on Digital Divide, Rabia Yemin interviews Howard Bloom, author of The God Problem. They discuss secular shamanism, aspiring toward omniscience, LSD, doing the work of the universe, Prince, Amanda Palmer, leptones, mindgasms, bar and God jokes, the universe, and so much more. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support in our recent membership drive. If you missed it, you can still contribute by going to kboo.fm and click on Donate Today.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to broadcast live from the Inner City Blues Festival, Saturday, April 13th, from 7 to 10 p.m. Healthcare for All Oregon is throwing a party called the Inner City Blues Festival, Healing the Healthcare Blues, in the Groove of Love. Northwest Blues Stars are returning for a night of music that will benefit the work of statewide coalition Healthcare for All Oregon for universal, affordable healthcare for all Oregonians. KBOO is proud to help sponsor the Inner City Blues Festival to take place Saturday, April 13th at the Melody Ballroom, 615 Southeast Alder. Doors at 6, and KBOO's live broadcast starts at 7. More information can be found at kboo.fm/innercitybluesfestival2013.
KBOO's broadcast of this event will run 7 p.m. until midnight.
KBOO Community Radio continues the broadcast of the 2013 ILHI Lecture Series on Wednesday, April 24th, when we'll broadcast a talk by Catherine Austin Fitz.
Managing member of Solari Investment Advisory Services, Catherine Austin Fitz is also a publisher of the Solari Report. She served as Assistant Secretary of Housing, Federal Housing Commissioner in the first Bush administration, and Managing Director of Wall Street firm Dillon Reed & Co., Inc. Fitz has designed and closed over 25 billion transactions and investments to date and has led portfolio investment